Hello, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon, your community radio station. I'm Gene Bradley, and today in the KBOO studio, we welcome Nathaniel Philbrick, the author of The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. The Last Stand has just come out in paperback, published by Penguin Books. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, it's great to
be here.
Thanks
for coming. Appreciate that. Your previous books, Mayflower in 2006, which is a top 10 New York Times selection, In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex, which was a National Book Award, and The Sea of Glory were all about what you call the watery wilderness of the sea. You say when you finished Mayflower in 2006, you were finally ready to tackle the story of Custer and the Little Bighorn. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, with Mayflower, that's obviously the story of Plymouth Colony. And for most of us, we think of it ending with the first Thanksgiving. I took it to the next generation, which led to King Philip's War, this terrible encounter between Native and English peoples in Plymouth Colony that most people have never heard of, but which changed everything in Massachusetts and in many ways prefigured the Indian Wars of the West. And as you said, I've been writing primarily about the wilderness of the water, and yet the wilderness most of us associate with America is the West. And I thought, well, okay, if this was my take on the iconic beginning, where does that process that leads to these terrible wars ultimately lead in an iconic sense? Well, it's the Battle of Little Bighorn. And I had seen Little Big Man as a high schooler. And, you know, Custer is the deranged maniac of the Vietnam War, really. And I just was fascinated with the story and had always had my antennae out. And after Mayflower, I thought, you know, I want to go to, and each book has to be different. I just have to have something to learn. I just don't want to repeat myself. And I thought, this is going to be, you know, a voyage into uncharted waters in the center of this continent.
And you've said that The Last Stand, you saw it as a culmination rather than a departure from the previous books. It's just seeing the story forward to, in some sense, its end.
Yeah, and you know, and what I was really curious about was, you know, what, how do they compare the wilderness of water and the wilderness of the West? And there are obvious dissimilarities, but I was taken by the continuities. You know, the Nantucketers pursuing the sperm whale across the vast reaches of the Pacific is a lot like Native Americans pursuing the buffalo across the northern plains. And the whole sense of oceanic space is a part of being in the plains.
So you spent 4 years researching this book and writing this book, 2006, when you were finally finished with Mayflower, which is a great, great book. We have to talk about that another time, but 4 years. So how did you really get into that?
Well, you know, it changed my life, really. You know, I am a coastal person. Although I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and grew up with rivers, since then I've been pretty much on Nantucket in the Atlantic. And so this was, going west for me was a whole new terrain, and I really committed myself from the very beginning to spending a lot of time out there. And it wasn't until I had visited the battlefield, spent a couple of days in the Black Hills, that I realized, yes, this is where I want to go. And I've now been to the battlefield a total of 7 times. Several of the research trips were as many as 3 weeks. And, you know, after working on a book like Mayflower, where if you go to a historic site, there's a Dunkin' Donuts across the street. If you go to South Central Montana today, where the battlefield is located, you're seeing in many cases what Custer and Sitting Bull saw. The population is that low. And so seeing, experiencing the landscape became a tremendous part of my research process.
And you even at one point rode a horse across the terrain.
I am not much of a horse guy. This is actually my second time on a horse, but I really felt it was important if I was going to have any understanding of what it was like during this battle, when most people were mounted, at least for a portion of it. I had to ride a horse, and so contacted Charlie Realbird, who is a Crow tribal member, and he took me out. He put me on a horse named Tomcat, which concerned me, especially since he said it had been a rodeo horse. And I said, well, how am I going to do that? He said, don't worry, it's 27 years old. And Tomcat was a little friskier than I would have liked, but it was an experience I'll never forget, because we were following the real Bird family actually owns portions of the battlefield. It's still in private hands. And so they have access. And so we rode these horses across the battlefield, following trails that took us right to the edge of a 300-foot precipice overlooking the Little Bighorn, and where we're basically going from where Custer's portion of the battle was to where Reno's siege was conducted. And they're separated by almost 7 miles. So it's a vast terrain. And it's a space that you cannot really understand unless you're on a horse, because it changes your mobility, it changes your perspective. And what I was astonished by was this, that when you look at the battlefield from a distance, it looks like it's sort of rolling, smooth plains. But when you're on it, when you get swallowed up by it so quickly, and then you begin to realize that even though this is a vast battlefield, there were micro portions of it, so that, you know, a whole group of warriors and soldiers could be fighting in one section and have no idea what was happening to people just a few miles away.
And in fact, that's one of the big stories of the battle itself, is that, you know, the various pieces of it didn't know what the other people were doing. And Custer never did have a real good sense of the enemy, it seems.
Right. Well, you know, and terrain is everything. Custer, you're right, could not see the Lakota Cheyenne village of 8,000 people, and his regiment was only 650. He could not see the village until he was almost right on it, because this deceptive landscape was hiding the village until you were right on top of it. And his biggest concern was not that they were going to stumble upon a huge village that would annihilate them. His biggest concern was the concern every Army officer had at this time, was that given the extreme mobility of the Lakota and Cheyenne, that it would disperse before they had a chance to attack it. That was his chief concern. And so he divided his command into three battalions in anticipation of this village dispersing. And his scouts were telling him that's what they thought was happening. But once again, they couldn't see it. You know, they could see smoke and dust, but they could not see the village. And so he sent Major Marcus Reno charging down the river towards the still unseen village. He sent Captain Frederick Benteen to the left to capture any people escaping in that direction. And then he swung to the right up onto the same bluffs I was riding on Tomcat. And from those bluffs, he saw for the first time this immense village of 1,000 teepees, and he was elated. He thought this was going to be the ultimate making of his career.
With 650 men.
Yeah. Well, he thought he had caught them sleeping in their teepees, and they were they didn't see many warriors. They could see a lot of women and children, and they thought maybe the warriors were off hunting or something like that. And of course, it all quickly began to deteriorate from his perspective, as he realized that no, there were plenty of warriors still there.
Let's take a step back for a second and talk about Custer a little bit. You know, this great American hero, who you describe as a real lightning rod, cultural lightning mm-hmm. rod. I mean, between Little Big Man and Errol Flynn, and They Died With Their Boots On,
right.
You just have the polarity there. You call him a true prodigy of war. Could you talk about his rise?
Yeah, it was incredible. He graduated last in his class in West Point, and he graduated just within weeks of Bull Run. And so he was a fresh cadet at Bull Run, and he would, from there, be present at just about every major battle in the Eastern Theater of the Civil War. And within 2 years of graduating last at West Point, he would be a brigadier general. And, you know, in his 20s. And he'd be a major general by the time the war was ended. And so this is a guy who basically grows up under the spectacular conditions of war, and where a cavalry charge was almost a daily occurrence. And he loved it. I mean, he was wired for the chaos of war. I mean, it was the only time where he really felt at peace, I think, in a personal way, was when he was completely involved in an amazing peripheral vision. He was a spectacular human specimen. He was in great shape. But his victories were based on audacity, and not necessarily on judgment. And I think that would ultimately come to haunt him, of course, in 1876 at the Little Bighorn.
Now, in your book, you state that, that many claim that he actually saved the day at Gettysburg.
Yes.
By leading the Michigan Wolverine unit
right.
against a vastly superior force commanded by Jeb Stuart, who was attempting to attack from the rear. Can you describe that?
Yeah, this is a relatively little-known portion of the battle. You know, it's not really even mentioned, for example, in that great book about Gettysburg, Killer Angels. Mm-hmm. This was sort of behind Pickett's, you know, there was Pickett's charge, which we all know about. This was going on the other side, in which Jeb Stuart was hoping to punch through. And we're not really sure, it's hazy because, you know, the exact tactics that people had in mind were not necessarily completely revealed. But apparently Jeb Stuart was trying to punch through and meet Pickett, which would have divided the Federal forces and could have led to Lee's greatest victory. And Jeb Stuart seemed poised to do that. He outnumbered the small group of Michigan Wolverines led by none other than Custer. And so they went tearing across Custer and his men, you know, come on, you Wolverines! And they went off and they collided with such an impact that some of the troopers were found with their sabers actually having clenched their enemies. You know, they were mm-hmm. you know together and set that way. And it's just somehow Custer was able to force Jeb Stuart ultimately to cease and desist. And it's been argued that you could say that if that hadn't happened, it could have been a Confederate victory. That's somewhat of a controversial position, but you have to give, you know, we think of Custer as history's biggest loser because of what ultimately happened to him. But the fact of the matter was, in the Civil War, he was a very capable cavalry officer.
And after the Civil War, his career seemed to
wander.
Yes. I guess I was going to say dip and return.
Right. But. You know, Custer had this thing he called Custer luck.
Yeah.
That, you know, whenever things were bad, don't worry. You know, a bolt would come from the blue and rescue him. And it happened time and time again. Even in the Civil War, there were times where, you know, he'd get so far behind enemy lines, it looked like, you know, they're going to get captured or if not wiped out. And somehow he'd get his out of it. And when it came to the West, he had plenty of setbacks. The wars of the West were very different from the Civil War. I think it's almost like the transition from World War II to Vietnam, where, you know, one war is, you know, moral right and wrong is understandable. But in Vietnam, there were a lot of non-combatants that got drawn into conflicts. And that's what happened in the Wars of the West, where you were routinely attacking villages of women and children. And it was hard to maintain discipline, to maintain anything, really. And and so Custer ran into, and it was frustrating, too, because the Cheyenne, who were the first native groups he was pursuing, were, you know, just so good on the horses that they're just making a mockery of his attempts to try to bring them in. And so he got very frustrated, and add to this that gold had been recently discovered and many of his men were leaving for the gold, and so leaving for the gold fields, and desertions were a big problem. And so he got court-martialed for basically abusing his men, for leaving his regiment improperly to track down his wife Libby, who he adored. And so he was sentenced to a year with no pay, and it looked like this was the end of his career. And then Custer luck struck, and Sheridan said, "I need you to lead a winter campaign against the Cheyenne," and thus came his first great victory of the West, the Battle of the Washita.
And after that battle, he got a lot of criticism for it. And by that time, he's a lieutenant colonel. He's no longer General Custer. He's a lieutenant colonel, not even on paper able to command the 7th Cavalry. They get around that with some bookkeeping. But
yeah.
But he becomes a peacemaker. He becomes noted for his ability to negotiate with the tribes and his diplomacy.
Right. And this is a era of his career, I think, about which most people are unaware. Custer, in the Battle of the Washita, attacked a small village that seems in retrospect to have been led by a peace chief. And so he was duly criticized for it. And he had justifiable reasons for the attack. from his point of view. And he realized that he had been beaten up in the press so much that he needed to help establish a different kind of reputation. And so he launched on a very long and required quite a bit of bravery, a diplomatic effort in which he and just one other officer went into a Cheyenne encampment and convinced them ultimately to come into the reservation. And his account of this, his initial time in the West, it's called My Life on the Plains. He ends it quite proudly with this moment of negotiation, where instead of attacking the village when all his men were saying we need to attack, he talked. And so going into the Battle of Little Bighorn, he clearly, you know, he could go both ways when it came to his attitude towards the native people.
So 1874, gold is discovered in the Black Hills. The U.S. government tells the Sioux, you have to report to the reservation or we're going to, it will be an act of war if you don't.
Right.
And you describe that as an unprovoked military invasion of basically an independent nation. Can you describe what was driving the United States to have this kind of policy?
Yeah, well, in 1874, there had been a financial panic, and the economy was in terrible straits. National debt was estimated at $1 billion, a huge sum then. Some things have never changed. And it was recognized that the discovery of gold was the best way to get the economy back on track. And Custer led an expedition to the Black Hills in 1874, and although he was supposed to look for a possible location of a fort, this was Lakota land, legally Lakota land, but he also brought along some gold prospectors who, wouldn't you know, discovered gold. Within a matter of months, thousands of miners had flooded into the Black Hills, and the Grant administration had a problem. Do we use the military to get the miners out, or do we use the military to insist that the Lakota sell? And we know what plan they took, and so the Battle of Little Bighorn was really, as you quoted there, an unprovoked attack on a people, to take a valuable portion of what was their land.
So the Lakota don't report to the reservation. 1876, spring 1876, Custer is part of the leadership of an expedition to round them up and bring them in, or whatever.
Yep.
And the Sioux are led by Sitting Bull.
Yes.
The other great player in the story.
Yeah.
And you say there are two last stands.
Right.
And you can't understand one without knowing the other.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we all know about Custer's last stand. And, you know, it's the brave leaders leading a small band against impossible odds. And even though everyone, they get wiped out, they win eternal victory, you know, by in defeat. But this is also the last stand of the Lakota and Cheyenne. It was a great Lakota victory. But within a year, just about every tribal member was on the reservation. The buffalo population would plummet with no way to feed themselves. They had no alternative. And so in many ways, this battle was the Lakota's last stand as well. And when you look at iconic moments, ultimately it would, there was the Battle of Little Bighorn, but then in 1890, by which time Sitting Bull was at the Standing Rock Sioux Agency in modern North Dakota, South Dakota border, right in there. There was the conditions of his people were at an all time low. The superintendent of the reservation believed Sitting Bull wanted to lead his people in a revolt using what was known as the ghost dance, which was a religious revival sweeping across the Western tribes, as a pretext to arrest him. He sent the Lakota police down to bring him in. Shots were fired, and Sitting Bull was killed. And a few of his family members escaped to the south to the Pine Ridge Agency, about 200 miles away, where some ghost dancers had been taken in by none other than Custer's old regiment, the 7th Cavalry. The next morning, they were told to turn over their weapons, and that morning shots were fired out and the massacre at Wounded Knee occurred. And this is the last stand I think we have to look at when we look at the Little Bighorn, because they are one and the same.
So the news of the defeat of Custer reaches the nation 3 days after July 4th, 1876, the celebration of the centennial of the country.
Yeah.
Huge shock. Now, as you're standing, after all these years of research, you're standing at Sitting Bull's cabin, you say, I know now that nothing ended at the Little Bighorn. In terms of the playing out at the Pine Ridge Massacre and beyond that, or do you have a greater sense of that in terms of America and how it thinks of itself and colonialism? Can
yeah.
you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, there were colonial wars all over the world when it came to the British Empire and all this, but our colonial wars were fought within our own land. And I think a lot of Americans, if you haven't been to that part of the country, don't realize that there is another nation, basically, in the center of this country, where what happened in the 19th century is still an ever-present part of what's going on there, particularly at the many reservations in the West. And so that battle was fought, you know, in the centennial of America. But, you know, what it was fought for never really ended when it comes to, I think, our country dealing with the issues of what it took to take this land. And so the battle hasn't ended. And I don't think any of us, you know, I think it's an ongoing open wound in a way that I think, you know, to be an American is a lot more than the founding fathers and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. There were stories that involved the wilderness that are essential to who we are as a nation and who we strive to be. And there's a lot of unfinished business out there.
In the end, how should we remember Custer and how should we remember Sitting Bull?
Yeah. Well, you know, they were very different men, but they were also representative men. And I think, you know, Custer was an outrageous character in many ways, but he was also an exaggerated version of what America was about at that point. You know, going in there, guns blazing, you know, getting it done for the greater glory, his own personal glory. You know, that's sort of what Americans wanted in their leaders. And you know, once the West was won, America then turned to the world, and there were wars in the Philippines and all over the, you know, the Spanish-American War. And you know, and Sitting Bull on the other side was someone who was another representative man, someone who saw that things were coming to a drastic, if not end, a change, and he looked to the absolute traditional side of his background, and you know, came to realize that some accommodation was required, but that the real spiritual strength of his people resided in that traditional background. And I think that is a message that is obviously of still great relevance. And I think, you know, those two sides are commonly the alpha and omega of what is America. And they're not necessarily reconcilable, but that's sort of the way America is.
I've had the great pleasure today of talking to Nathaniel Philbrick about his latest book, The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. It's been released in paperback now by Penguin Press. I really encourage people who are interested in America and the idea of America and American history to go out and get this book. This is just a great, great book. And one last question, and thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank
you.
But
one last question, how'd you feel the day you shipped this book to the publisher? This is a huge effort.
Oh, this was, you know, as I said to my wife on that day, I said, this book has aged me.
Well, it is a great, great work, and we really appreciate it. You've given us a great gift, and we thank you very much for coming in, and we really thank you for this book.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks again. Nathaniel Philbrick, the author of The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. The Last Stand has just come out in paperback, published by Penguin Books.